Vamos a dar inicio a nuestra primera conferencia magistral. Esta va a ser impartida por el doctor Stephen Downs. Y bueno, yo quisiera ponerlos en antecedente un poquito de quién es Stephen Downs. No sé si muchos de ustedes hayan escuchado hablar del conectivismo. El conectivismo es pues una teoría que está desarrollando Stephen a lo largo ya de unos 6-7 años junto con otro colega que se llama George Siemens. Y bueno, hoy tenemos la oportunidad de escucharlo aquí en vivo y a todo color al doctor Stephen Downs. Y yo quisiera pues decirles un poco cuál ha sido su trayectoria del doctor como un gran investigador. Básicamente él está en Nuevo Brunswick, en Canadá, desde 2001. Él está afiliado al Grupo de Tecnologías Colaborativas y Aprendizaje del Instituto de Información y Tecnología, y él se especializa en campos como los multimedios, la pedagogía y la filosofía. Yo creo que esta parte del conectivismo es algo muy interesante, que tiene como premisa fundamental el hecho de que no es tan importante lo que sabemos, lo que nuestro cerebro sabe, lo que conocemos, el conocimiento, sino las posibilidades que tenemos nosotros de conectarnos a través de otras gentes, con otros medios, con redes, para poder hacer mucho más potencial este conocimiento que tenemos. En ese sentido, el doctor Downs está desarrollando esa teoría y, bueno, tiene una página muy interesante que yo quisiera asignar. Yo creo que él nos lo va a dar en su presentación para que investiguemos. Tiene todo el recuento de todas sus investigaciones, sus publicaciones hechas. Yo creo que el doctor Downs nos va a mostrar, si ponen ustedes en internet, en cualquier buscador, Downs Stephen, van a ver que salen cosas maravillosas, va directamente a su página. Y bueno, ya no les puedo decir más. Yo quisiera que le echaran un vistazo a esta página que tiene el doctor para que vean y puedan bajar inclusive toda su obra a lo largo de todo el tiempo. Lo tiene de una manera muy estructurada, muy interesante, secuencial con respecto al tiempo. Y bueno, actualmente él nació en Montreal, en Quebec, en 1959, y tiene... está viviendo actualmente en Moncton, en Nuevo Brunswick, y viaja a menudo. Y bueno, no es la primera vez que nos acompaña aquí en México, sobre todo en Monterrey, es su segundo viaje. Y bueno, yo quisiera pedirles que le diéramos un fuerte aplauso al doctor Stephen Downs por acompañarnos esta mañana. Le damos la palabra.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. This is actually my first time in Monterrey. It's my first time in Mexico. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. I thought that you were...
No. No. Silly. So it's an extra pleasure for me to be here today. And I thank the organizers for the invitation, and I thank all of you for making the long trip up the hill to come see this talk today. It's my great, great pleasure to be here. Today I'll be talking on a topic called Dimensions of a Learning Network. I hope the slides come out okay. I noticed at the last minute the aspect ratio is a little off, but we'll make do. And if I have to fix the slide, I'll stop and fix the slide. In Canada, we have a humorist, a comedian by the name of Mike Bullard. He used to have a television show. It wasn't very good. Don't tell him I said that. But I saw him perform live last New Year's Eve. And he was very good. And he said at that show, he said, here is the secret to comedy. Find something you have in common with your audience. Bring them around to your point of view. And make them laugh at themselves. And I thought about it, and it's true, isn't it, that the best comedians talk about the things that we all know. I thought about it a little more, and I realized also that what he was saying is that the humor is not in the joke. The humor is not even in the teller of the joke or the telling of the joke. The humor is in the listener. The funny is in here. I wandered around the city yesterday, as I like to do, especially a new city for me. It's like exploring a new culture. And I don't know what the name of the building is, but it's not over there. It's down, way down there. It's at the end of the Macro Mall. And there was a large group dancing there, and there were musicians playing. I thought that was very interesting. And I was thinking at the time that dance is the same way. You know, there are rules to dance, and there is a public performance to dance, but that isn't the dance, right? The dance is in the dancer. The dance is in here. And I think that this is an important and underlying truth that we have to keep in mind always when we talk about knowledge, when we talk about learning. Now, what I want to talk about today is what I call learning networks, or networks that learn. I don't know how it translates into Spanish, but in English, there's a nice double meaning to this. I love double meanings. So much humor in English is based on double meanings. So, on the one hand, you have the use of networks in order to learn. And on the other hand, you have networks that are themselves able to learn. Learning networks. One word, or one phrase, two concepts. And at the core of what I have to say about learning is those two separate concepts are the same concept. Using networks to learn, networks that are able to learn, one and the same concept. And that's what the rest of this talk is about. Drawing that out, describing the conditions under which, describing the conditions under which networks learn, which are the same things as the conditions under which we use networks in order to learn. Right now, in technology, in the development of technology, the most advanced work, in my opinion, involving using networks to learn, is in the development of the personal learning environment. The idea of the personal learning environment is to place the learner into a network. Stay. That's not going to work. That was my mind. Sorry. This diagram here was created by Scott Wilson of CETUS in Britain It's a very famous diagram now. It's you see it all over the place. I feel almost embarrassed to be using it again. But it's a very good diagram because it illustrates the structure of the personal learning environment with the learner at the center, where it says future VLE, the circle, and then different services on the internet connected to the learner. There might be 43 things, or Flickr, or blog, or a learning management system. And the small print, which you can't really read, describes the technology, the protocols used to connect these different elements of the network. In Canada, I have a project. Oh, surprise. Let's try unplugging the internet. Nope. Okay. You like that, eh? We'll get her yet. I am nothing if not persistent. Okay, I'm not that persistent. Okay, no internet. Yay! The unfortunate thing is internet was working.
Okay, you can get the net from here. Well, this will give you the...
But I can't show, they won't be able to see the screen.
No. You will get, this is like a modem. This is a modem. You can do it. Just get there. Okay. This would work.
It should work. It was working. It was working.
This is to connect to internet. This is a portable device.
Yes, sir. You can get the net from here. That's the way I just look at network that it says Yola. Where you can see your network?
Yeah,
you get this.
I have no idea how this.
Just locate the available networks.
Okay, it's okay. Let me continue the talk, and I'll just, because I can't solve technical problems and do a talk at the same time. So it's okay. I don't know why it's not, and I don't know how this would connect me, but I'll give it one more try. Okay, well, that's really too bad. That is connected. See, it should work. Well, should be fine. Just a matter of seconds here, everyone. Okay, it looks like maybe the wireless simply isn't going to work for me. Oops. No. All right. No matter. I will continue on. You'll just have to imagine you're looking at my website and it has a nice diagram on the front and it says PLERN. You can see the word now, and PLERN stands for Personal Learning Environment Research Network. And this is our project that we are running at the National Research Council right now. And the purpose of PLEARN is to build a tool that is like what you saw in the diagram. You notice I still don't give up. Is like what you saw in the diagram, which is a personal learning network. I'll make this big again. Now, we've used these tools to offer some online courses in Canada. Myself and George Siemens ran a course in 2008 called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. Some of you may be familiar with it. And what was interesting about that course was that we very deliberately designed the course to be a network. If you think about a typical course that you would take in a school or in a university, it does not look like a network at all. It looks like a book, right? You have different chapters, and you go through it in a very linear fashion, and attached to each chapter are the readings and the assignments that you do. And everybody in the class progresses in a nice, neat manner through the contents of the course. Our course looked like that. And that is actually a drawing that one of the students in the course made of the course. So that network is what our course looked like. One more try. Nope. I had to try. Now, I want to contrast for a moment between the way people normally talk, not just about online learning, but about network phenomena on the internet generally. And they very often talk in rooms like that with a speaker at the front of the room and everybody attentively listening, taking notes. And if you read, you know, you read the literature, the cyber literature, the way pundits talk about the web, they talk about power and power laws. They talk about trust. There's a lot of talk about trust on the internet these days. And incentives and motivations to get people to learn, right? They talk about the propagation of an idea or a message, the broadcast of a message. They talk about the way a meme goes from person to person to person, the spreading of ideas. They talk about messaging generally. They are very focused on the content. Oh, but I lose one thing. What do I want to lose? I will lose my mouse. It's not going to fit. Uh-oh. Okay. It's a nice try, but it doesn't fit. Because I don't want to lose my microphone, because that's my only record of this. So they talk about content. The focus is on the thing you learn. The focus is on the sentence, the structure, the grammar, the meaning, the semantics. All of these things that are outside of us. But all of these things that are intended to be the property of one person being passed on to another. This is a world of mass. It is a world of voting, of movements, of people lining up behind an idea, of collective intelligence, of value statements and mission statements. This is an older way of thinking. And I want to replace the concept of collective intelligence with the more accurate concept of connective intelligence. Because the reason why a network learns, the reason why a society is more than any of its members, is that what is important is not the content of one particular member, but rather the way all the different members of the society are organized together. You know, we normally think of knowledge and learning as passing this piece of content from one person to another person to another person. But that isn't learning. Right? Because what that means is we're trying to make everybody the same. A mass. But if you make everybody the same, you undercut, you erode, you even destroy the possibility of interaction. Because everybody says the same thing. There is nothing new. What makes a network learn is when the different parts of the network say different things. And communication goes back and forth between them, and then the learning of the network is the sum total of this communication. So that's why I say connective intelligence, the intelligence we have from connecting, rather than collective intelligence, the intelligence we have as a mass. If you think about it, this is a distinction we already understand. If you think about a sandcastle, what's important about a sandcastle is not the fact that it's made up of sand. It's not the individual grains of sand. It's not how many grains of sand there are. It's how they're organized. The way the grains of sand are organized is what makes it a castle. Nothing else. You can exchange every single piece of sand with a new piece of sand, you still have a castle. It'd be hard to do, but you can do it. The theory of connectivism is based on this concept of knowledge. And it's a bit tricky to grasp at times. Because in an important way, there isn't a thing there to grasp. The official statement, if you will, of connectivism is that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections. It's not the single idea passed from person to person to person. It is the many different ideas that people have taken together. And correspondingly, learning is the ability to traverse and grow those networks. Now you might ask, what does it mean to say knowledge is distributed across a network of connections? Well, I want you to imagine some piece of knowledge that we have as a society. And an example I like to use a lot, and sorry if you've heard this one before, the knowledge of how to fly a jet airplane from Paris to New York. Now, we know how to do this, right? We see planes fly from Paris to New York every single day. Think about the knowledge involved. You have to know how to fly an airplane. Very important. Even more important, you have to know how to land an airplane. You have to know how to make tires. You have to know how to make windshields. You have to know how to serve champagne in business class. You have to know how to take ticket reservations. You have to know about security. You have to know about navigation. And, of course, I could go on, right? All of these different things, all of these things that you have to know in order to fly an airplane from Paris to New York. Now, when I ask, where is that knowledge located, nobody can tell me. Because it's not in any one place. There are bits of knowledge in the pilot, in the flight attendant, in the navigator, in the air traffic controller, in the factory that builds tires, in the security office. The knowledge of how to fly a plane is scattered across thousands of people. No one person knows how to do all of that. No one person could know how to do all of that. So our knowledge is based on everybody knowing different knowledge, and then, very importantly, these people connecting. These people exchanging what they know with each other in order to pull together and create this larger organization that is the knowledge of how to fly a plane from Paris to New York. Now, the claim of connectivism is all of our knowledge is like that. All of it. Think about something very simple. Think about the meaning of the word Paris. The meaning of the word Paris does not exist in any one place. It's in you, and 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 it's different in each person. Right? And socially, we would say the meaning of the word Paris is the way all of these people with individual meanings of the word Paris combine and interact. So that's the theory of connectivism. That's the theory of distributed knowledge and networks of knowledge. How does that theory apply to learning? Well, remember, I said we don't want everyone having the same knowledge. People have to have different knowledge. So in a connectivist course or a connectivist learning program, there is no curriculum. There is no body of knowledge. Or, let me be more accurate, because I don't want to say something that is transparently false. There is a curriculum out there. There are things that people talk about. There are things that people say. There are textbooks. There is content. But this curriculum is not the object of our learning. This curriculum is like a tool that we use in order to create our learning. It's what fiction writers would call a MacGuffin. I'm going to type it for you. Yeah, sure, auto-recover. There we go. It's a MacGuffin right there. What a MacGuffin is in fiction is a device, a plot device, around which all of the interactions of the main characters revolve. You've heard of the movie The Maltese Falcon? Have you? Someone? Pardon? Humphrey Bogart, yes. In The Maltese Falcon, everybody's trying to get this statue of a bird, right? The Maltese Falcon. But the bird isn't the important thing of the movie. You don't even see it till the end. The bird, the Maltese Falcon, is the MacGuffin. But what's really important is the relation between the detective and the other parties in the story. right? The content of a course, the content of a learning program is like that. It's the MacGuffin. It is the center around which we build our networks and around which we create an environment where we learn how to be a person who is an expert in that discipline. Because, as the second line there says, the product of learning is not the content. The product of learning is the learner. The learning is in here, like the humor, like the dance. It is something that is developed, something that is grown. That connectivist duck works. That is incredibly funny in English. Probably less so in Spanish. This is a diagram. See what I mean? The humor is in the... This is a diagram that one of the participants of our current online course on personal learning environments has created. And it describes the activity taking place inside the course. And in the body of the duck, you can't really read it there, is the activity that the person undertakes inside their personal learning network. On the one hand, reading things from other people, and on the other hand, writing things. And by writing things, making new connections, that's the tail, and then those new connections feed back into the network. And then up at the head are all the artifacts that the person creates in the course, the presentations, the mind maps, the videos, the interactives, the pictures, and even some text. Duckworks. And the idea here of a connectivist course is not receiving a pile of knowledge. It is undertaking these activities, this network of activities, inside a network, being a part of that network. See, it's not like there's nothing to learn. There is a lot to learn. And in fact, the problem is there is more to learn in any discipline than we can teach people. There's too much. And even more, it's not only that there's too much, it changes. Yesterday to today to tomorrow, it changes all the time. But even more than that, what there is to learn is complex. It cannot be grasped. And so it needs to be navigated, not memorized. Now, what do I mean by complex? I don't just mean complicated. I don't just mean made up of many parts. Complexity is a different order of difficulty. Something is, or a system is complex when a system is made up of multiple parts, one part, another part, another part, that are interconnected, and when you change one part, it affects another part, and it affects another part, affects another part, and then it affects the thing that you changed in the first place. So you can't hold the thing constant. You make a change here, it changes the thing that you tried to change. You get what some people call unintended consequences. You try to hold salaries steady, and the result is runaway inflation. You know what I mean? It's complex in the sense that there is no state that we can grasp. There is nothing that we can actually remember. The only way to manage a complex environment is to navigate that environment. think about a surfer surfing on a wave. This is an example that Douglas Rushkoff came up with in his book Siberia. A surfer does not try to get to know the wave, right? Doesn't try to memorize what the wave looks like. Couldn't do it, right? A wave is a complex environment. All the surfer can do is react to the wave. There's still knowledge there, right? There are good surfers and bad surfers, and you can tell the difference. We can all tell the difference. But it's not based on the facts that they can repeat. It's based on their ability to work in, react with, and navigate this environment. It's almost like a performance. It's almost like a dance. It's a state of mind that is an awareness of the wave, but is not facts or knowledge of the wave. The tool that I've built to attempt to, you know, give people, if you will, a surfboard, that's a good metaphor, I have to remember that, is called Grasshopper. And Grasshopper is the tool that we use right now to support our personal learning environment networks and knowledge course, and also the Connectivist course. And the idea of Grasshopper is it creates these connections. And I would show you. Let's give it a shot. We'll see what happens. Nope. Okay. I tried. But the URL is there. And when you go to my website later today, you'll see all of this anyway. So you'll see this presentation and you can follow the links. And the idea here of Grasshopper is different from a content management system or a learning management system. In these learning management systems or content management systems, we're trying to bring in content and bring in a mass of students and organize them all like it was a book. But with Grasshopper, the objective is to give an individual the capacity to be a single node in a network, a single node that connects out to other people, a single node that knows how to navigate an airplane, a single node that can work with that network as though it were a wave or as though it were a dance. So when I tell people, how do you learn in a network? How do you learn in a connectivist course? What I say is, we function as if we are nodes in a network. And what that means is fourfold. Aggregate, receive signals from outside of you, from the rest of the world. Remix, combine those signals in new ways. Repurpose, add our own awareness, our own capacities, our own skill, our own creativity to what we have aggregated. And then feed forward, send our signal out to the other nodes in the network. It's almost like we're little information processors, each doing our own little thing, right? Marvin Minsky talked about the society of mind, and this is very similar to the picture that he proposes in that book. According to Minsky, the human mind is made up of individual agents, and these agents form a society, and every agent does their own individual thing. Some are pushers, some are pullers, some are diggers. All the agents do different things, but they communicate, they connect with each other. And their individual activities connected is what creates a mind. It's an interesting picture. I like it. Craig Newmark, who founded Craigslist, says the same thing. How does he manage Craigslist? He says, listen to people, repeat what they say to other people, get out of the way. Well, of course, You know, it's not just repeating, it's not just passing along the message, it's creating your version of the message and passing it along. That is important. We create our own knowledge, our own neural net, by participation in the social network. If you think about that, you know that that's true. Our own knowledge is formed in our mind. It's formed by creating connections between neurons in our mind. These connections are created as the result of experience, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And so, we develop our own learning by participation in this wider network. It's like we learn about surfing by surfing. We learn about climbing trees by climbing trees. We learn about dance by dancing. You can't do it any other way. We learn about physics by doing physics. Learning is not simply the acquisition of the facts of the matter. Learning is the growth of the neural net. And it is this growth that is the objective of a learning experience or a learning environment. Now, I want to pause here and be careful, because it's easy to get some things confused. Now, I want to draw this out. Because, really, when you think about it, there are two different kinds of knowledge. On the one hand, we have public knowledge, or I actually more frequently call it, I don't have a mouse. Sorry, I'm never happy with my slides. On the one hand, we have social knowledge, or public knowledge. This is knowledge like how to fly an airplane from Paris to New York. This is the knowledge that is created by the interactions between all of us as human beings and the assembly of artifacts into an organization or a structure. It's like building sandcastles. It's exactly like building sandcastles. There's a phrase for this, stigmergy. And the idea of stigmergy is the idea of creating knowledge and communicating with each other by organizing artifacts. You think about an anthill, how ants build anthills. And no individual ant knows how to build an anthill. But the ants take a grain of sand and put it here. Take a grain of sand and put it here. And the ants just aren't communicating with each other directly. They communicate with each other by means of these pieces of sand. So public knowledge is communication and creation of knowledge by means of the placement of artifacts. Communication, yes, but the placement of artifacts. We'll put a word here. We'll put a diagram here. We'll put a tire here. We'll put a road here. These are all acts of communication. This is why I walk around cities and take pictures. Your city is an act of communication. I come here to Monterey. The people of Monterey speak to me through their artifacts. It's a language. It's very much a language. And it's very important for me to listen to what the city has to say to me before I speak to people in the city. But that's one kind of knowledge. That's the knowledge that we're more familiar with. It's sentences, it's books, it's propositions. The other kind of knowledge is what Michael Polanyi calls personal knowledge. This is the knowledge we have each individually ourselves. It is not made up of words and sentences. It is patterns of connectivity in the mind. It is connections between neurons. Now, what's important here is, on the one hand, we have public knowledge or social knowledge, which is a network. And on the other hand, we have private knowledge or personal knowledge, which is also a network. And in connectivism, what we have observed and what we say is that there is a common set of principles underlying both public knowledge and personal knowledge. And in fact, these are just two examples of networks in general, and there can be many types of knowledge. These are just two examples of them. Public knowledge that we have as a society, personal knowledge that we have as an individual. Oh, this is not going to work, is it? Oh, that's too bad. Oops. Back here. All right. Okay, I'm not going to be able to show you this link, unfortunately, but that diagram there, that's a video, and if you follow that link, you can see that video. Those two things on top of the piece of wood are metronomes. And for those of you who are musicians, you'll know what they are, but for those of you who are not, what a metronome is a thing that goes back and forth, tick-tock, tick-tock, right, and keeps time for you as a musician. They're pretty cool devices. I'm a terrible musician, so I've never used one. But they operate all by themselves on principles of, you know, they have springs. They're a lot like a clock. Well, I guess exactly like a clock, now that I think about it. So in this example, we have two metronomes beside each other. They're on a piece of wood, and then the piece of wood is sitting on two pop cans. If you have metronomes, you can actually do this yourself. I don't know of anyone who has metronomes, but... So, anyhow, in the video, what they do is they start them off, tick, 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 right? They're not, you know, they're each doing their own thing. And what's interesting is, if you just let them go, over time, tick, 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 they begin to swing tick, 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 together, like that. I've seen videos where you have five of them, right? And they all start off, they're all different, and they're running, and they all end up in sync. Is it Watts? Yeah, Duncan J. Watts talks about crickets. I think it's Watts. I can never remember. That's what I get for ad-libbing. But you have a cricket at night. Cricket goes chirp, chirp, chirp. Do you have crickets here? You must have crickets. Yeah. So, well, I don't know. How would I know? It's not in Wikipedia. I should go to Wikipedia. Yes, they have crickets in Monterey. And he noticed that the crickets chirped as though they were an orchestra. You know, they're all in sync. He thinks, how could they do this? Right? There's no head cricket. Crickets are so stupid, even if there was a head cricket, the cricket would not be able to organize anything. But crickets, you know, they chirp and they end up chirping in sync. And it's because they hear each other. Just like the metronomes here are connected by means of that piece of wood. And the connection, the very fact that the one metronome can influence the other through that piece of wood is what leads them to organize. To swing back and forth in sync. This is the idea of networks that learn. Right? This is the idea of networks that organize themselves. And in nature especially, but you know, just generally, there are example after example after example of networks that organize themselves, of individuals connected to each other that create a form of organization, a recognizable pattern of activity that we can see. So it's these underlying principles of self-organization that are described by graph theory, that are described by the computational theory of connectionism, described by people like Rummelhart and McClellan, Minsky and Papert and others, that underlie, oh, there was a third one, I just forgot, I should have written it down, underlying principles of ecology. These underlying principles are what underlie what we have to say about how learning is organized in a network. This is our fundamental structure of how we learn and how we organize learning. What is that structure? What are the actual mechanics? Well, obviously it's not going to be possible to cover in this short time, but I can talk a little bit about some of the methods that networks use in order to form connections. The human brain, when it learns, forms connections. This is a phenomenon known as plasticity. And here are four ways that humans or networks in general form connections. There may be other ways. I'm not going to say this is an exhaustive list by any means. It's a matter for empirical investigation. Once we know what we're looking for, it will become clearer. But one way is similarity. Two things that are similar to each other tend to connect. Like attracts like. Another is proximity, or what David Hume would call contiguity. Things are next to each other. First we have the cause, then we have the effect that leads us to draw a linkage between the two. Another is feedback, or what Rummelhart and McClellan called back propagation. It's the correction of errors. We have a certain organization which produces some kind of output. We say something, and we get a correction, and that changes the organization. And then there's a fourth mechanism based on harmony, or based on principles of thermodynamics, called a Boltzmann mechanism. That's also described in Rummelhart and McClellan's parallel distributed processing. And the idea is that a network of connections form at the most thermodynamically efficient state. And it's a process of shaking your network and letting it settle, shaking your network and letting it settle. These are mechanisms by which we form these connections. And these four mechanisms inform the sort of pedagogy that we would use. They inform the sort of structure that we would use in order to create networks. Now, there's no guarantee that if you use a network that you will reach the right result, right? There are things called cascade phenomena. The cascade phenomena is when you have something going through the network rapidly, an idea spreading from person to person. A cascade phenomena is like the outbreak of an epidemic in a society. Somebody has cholera, then two people, then four people, and then everybody in society has cholera. A cascade phenomenon is when one power station goes down, and then the next two go down, and the next two go down, and your entire power grid collapses. A cascade phenomenon is when you have a tune in your head, you can't get it out. It's a runaway network. It's a network rapidly progressing to a state where every member of the network has the same value. The outcome of a cascade phenomenon is what I would call network death. It's a ceasing or a cessation of communication between the nodes in the network because they've all become the same. Now, it turns out And you can show this mathematically, and I've done work with Seb Paquette and Daniel Lemire to begin to show this mathematically, that the design of the network impacts whether you have cascade phenomena. The design of the network determines the stability of the network. Here we have a fairly traditional network. Here we have a network diagram that we see in a lot of writing about network. It's got power laws in it. It's a broadcast network because it has a few single sources. It's a network based on mass, right? It's based on hierarchy and propagation. If you diagram it, it looks like a tree structure. That's a basic tree structure. And if you map the number of connections per unit in the network, you get what they call a power law. You have a few units with a great deal of connectivity and a large number of units, what they call the long tail, with very few connections. This is an unstable network. This is a network that is more prone to cascade phenomena. And it's more prone to cascade phenomena because if you get one of those central nodes to communicate something rapidly, most of your network has that thing. You see that node in the center there? If that node has cholera, everyone has cholera. Alternatively, there are networks that look more like the human brain, where you do not have hubs and spokes like the previous network. The email network from one person to another is more like this. We each have a few people that we send to. Maybe a few dozen of our closest friends. If you have one person sending thousands of emails, that's a problem. We call that spam. And that's actually a weakness in the email network. These networks are stable. These networks resist cascade phenomena. These networks can sustain patterns of connectivity. These networks can sustain distributed knowledge. So the principles that create these kind of networks are the principles that ought to govern the way we structure learning networks. The principles that describe how we form these networks are the principles that describe how we ought to offer learning online in a network and how we ought to approach learning as an individual. These are networks where there is a limit to the scale. I like this. This is a boat network. There are networks everywhere. This is a boat network. And you notice in this network, it's not a scale-free network in the sense that you can't keep adding boats to boats, right? Because boats have a certain size. And so there's only so many boats you can attach to a boat. This network, if you mapped it out, would look like this, not like this. There's no head boat there. Each boat has three or four boats connected to it, no more. It's limited by an upper scale. And in general, when networks are limited by some physical constraint, these networks are stable. They form the mesh pattern. When they're not limited by some constraint, then they tend to form these hubs and spokes. The principles that create this limitation, here are a bunch of them. Sorry about that. And it's only coincidence that they all start with D. It's because they're all sort of like negative, like D this or dis that. In English, the negatives all start with D. So decentralize, things in different places. Distribute, like distributed knowledge. disintermediate, allow for direct connections between individuals in the network. Disaggregate, take things apart, spread them out. Democratize, I will talk about that in a separate slide. Dynamize, allow for action, activity. And desegregate, instead of thinking of clumps and masses, break them apart and think of individuals with some space between them. Now, all of these are all physical characteristics of the network, and these are characteristics that network designers, like those people who design the internet, are well aware of and implement. Can you just imagine if they tried to build the internet like they tried to build a company, right? The internet would all be in one big place. There would be one big, huge building somewhere called the internet, and we'd all connect to it. That would be a really bad way to do it, right? That's how they used to do it, though. In companies like America Online and CompuServe, right? You would all connect to CompuServe, and that was your internet. It's much better now, where you have like hundreds of thousands of different web servers. It'd be very difficult to destroy the internet now. Now, the semantic principle, the democracy of the internet, is based on four fundamental principles. Again, there might be more principles. There might be more or less principles. These are certainly not unique to me. James Surowiecki, for example, in The Wisdom of Crowd, talks about diversity. These four principles are autonomy, diversity, openness, and interaction. Autonomy, the individuals in a network, whether they're people or neurons or ants or crickets, operate on their own. They make their own decisions. They follow their own values. Insofar as a cricket can have a value, it follows it. They don't serve collective values. And we recognize that the individuals in this network have their own purpose, their own objective, their own goal that they're trying to satisfy. And that the organization of these people is the interaction between these different goals. Those of you who are involved in the management of organizations or institutions, when you think about trying to have an institutional value that everybody will accept, you're working against this principle. Because the reality of an institution is people work in an institution in order to satisfy their own objectives, not the institution objectives. And institutions need to recognize that. And the growth of an institution and the strength of an institution is the working together of these individual values. Mutual exchange of value for mutual benefit. Related to autonomy is diversity. The expectation that there will be different points of view, different perspectives, different beliefs, different ways of interpreting the world, different meanings of the word Paris. Everybody has their own contribution, and they're all different. It's like that old parable of the elephant, and I'm sure you've all heard the old parable of the elephant, where one person touches a tusk, and another person touches the trunk, and another person touches the ear. You've all heard it, right? And each person has their own individual perspective, but you need all of those perspectives in order to understand that what you're dealing with is an elephant. And all of those perspectives are equally valuable. You know, the person who got the trunk, they're not more important because they got the trunk. It doesn't work that way. Openness is something very difficult for institutions to deal with, but openness is critical for a network to function. A network needs input from external to it, and it needs to be able to send out to it. It needs fluid boundaries. Even things that have a clearly defined outline, like the cell in a body, still needs to bring stuff in and send stuff out. It's metabolism. It's respiration. And it's a fundamental principle of network dynamics. And related to all of these is interaction. The idea that knowledge is formed in a network by the interaction, by the patterns of interaction formed by the communications between the members of the network, and not propagation of the state of one member to the next, to the next, to the next. They're pluralistic. Networks fundamentally are pluralistic. Now, I've talked a lot about theory in this talk, and I want to conclude by drawing out as clearly as I can the implication that these values are not simply abstract. But this is not, you know, airy theory. Now, my background is in philosophy. I can do airy theory. But what is important is the concrete impact that this has on your life as a learner, on your life as a teacher, or on your life as a manager. Because these values represent a change, a shift in value from ownership and control, from mass, right, to stewardship, agility, and stability. You don't own a network. At the very most, you can influence a network. You can have stewardship over it. The idea of managing a network makes no sense. You know, try telling crickets what to do. You can't, right? And really, when you think about it, you can't tell people what to do. You know, you have to convince them. And more, as people realize their role in society and the importance of their own perspective and their own diverse nature, the more it becomes the case where organization becomes an exchange of value rather than a command economy. But these principles even aren't just management principles or teaching principles, even if you're considering the purchase of software. Imagine you're looking at a new learning management system. You should ask yourself, does this learning management system promote autonomy, or does everybody have to think the same way? When Yahoo was first formed, Yahoo was great, they created a search index, and the way they did their searches, everything was categorized. And so you'd have, you know, countries, North America, Canada, right? Countries, North America, United States, and, or, you know, counties, North America, you know, they're all structured like a library. But to use Yahoo, you had to think like somebody from Yahoo. And if you didn't think the way they did, you would never find what you were looking for. You know, like, where do you put, I don't know. Never mind, I can't come up with an example on the fly. But ask yourself if the technology that you're using promotes diversity. Does everybody have to use Internet Explorer? Or can they use Firefox, Opera, Safari? The one that allows for diversity is better. Ask yourself if the technology you're purchasing is open. A learning management system puts up a big barrier between you and all those useful resources out there in the world. A better system would provide access to those resources. And ask yourself if the technology that you're looking at promotes interactivity and communication. You know, a simple little question. Is there a chat that goes with it? Is there a way for one person to communicate with another person? Or must they always go through the manager or the instructor? These practical applications of these principles to the choice of network technology is an example of how network principles inform day-to-day decisions. Well, that's my time for today, and I'd like to thank you very much for your patience. And if you would like to see more or send me messages or whatever, that's my website, and this presentation will be available on my website. So I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Bien, qué interesante la conferencia del doctor Stephen Downs. Y si ustedes se fijan en el título de las dimensiones de las redes de aprendizaje, ¿cuáles son esas dimensiones de una red de aprendizaje? Yo creo que nos dio puntos muy claves como cómo posicionar al aprendiz en una red. Eso es muy importante. Cómo ir de lo colectivo a lo conectivo a través de algo muy importante que tiene que ver con la organización, sin destruir la posibilidad de la interacción. Aquí él recupera esta parte de la interacción de una manera muy interesante y nos habla y contrapone la inteligencia conectiva con la inteligencia colectiva. Él propone que el conocimiento debe ser distribuido a través de una red de conexiones y concibe el aprendizaje como la habilidad de atravesar y hacer crecer esas redes de las que nos habló el doctor Downs. Nos dice también que todos conocemos, todos sabemos algo, y ese algo hay que aportarlo. Y un concepto fundamental habla del conocimiento distribuido y habla del proceso, habla del conocimiento como un proceso. El conectivismo, dice, no es un currículum ni formal ni oculto, no es un contenido. Los resultados del conectivismo tienen que ser producto del aprendizaje y es el propio aprendiz. Qué interesante cómo realizar y cómo hacer actividades dentro de la red. Y habla de un concepto también, navegación versus memorización. Y nos dice que todos podemos ser nodos, nodos simples de una red. ¿Cómo podemos ser nosotros mismos nodos? Bueno, habla del aprendizaje de estas redes como el propio conectivismo nos puede hacer que tengamos un aprendizaje inmersivo. Habló de las redes neurales, las sociales, porque dice que el aprendizaje crece. Y este conocimiento personal, social, público, como comunicación, como creación de conocimiento, ¿cómo puede ser o cómo puede pasar a crecer en una red en general? Y cómo podemos recuperar esos conjuntos, ese principio de conjuntos y pasar a hablar y crear una teoría de redes como la que nos está proponiendo. Cómo ir del conocimiento público al privado a través del conectivismo. Y habla del ejemplo de la sincronización a través de los metrónomos. Yo no sé si sería metrónomos. Para la organización nos mostró un poquito la teoría de grafos, la teoría de gráficas, para ver cómo el conectivismo puede organizar el aprendizaje en red, en una red, a través de ciertos principios como la asociación, la similaridad, la proximidad, la realimentación, la armonía de la propia red, y todo para hablar del fenómeno en cascada, y nos habló de la esperanza de vida de una red de aprendizaje, cómo se propaga, cómo se colapsa hasta llegar a su muerte, y después nos dice cómo pueden ser balanceadas, democráticas y estables estas redes de las que nos está proponiendo, cómo deben ser caracterizadas, cómo son deseables para pasar a ser una red autoorganizada, descentralizada, distribuida, diversa, autónoma, abierta, interactiva, desagregada, etcétera, etcétera, etcétera. Todo pues con un significado, porque nos habla y nos lleva a la red semántica que estamos ya viviendo en la red o la web 3. ¿Y qué importa todo esto si al final el impacto tiene que ser en el propio aprendiz, en el estudiante, en el aprendiente? Él nos deja muchas preguntas, el doctor Downs, y nos dice, pregúntense ustedes mismos si la tecnología les permite interactuar, les permite ser mejores educadores, ser mejores estudiantes y aprender las cosas de una mejor manera. Pues muchas gracias, doctor Downs. Yo no sé si haya preguntas, haya tiempo para preguntas, no, ¿verdad? Vamos a tener, fíjense ustedes, ya no hay tiempo para preguntas, pero vamos a tener la oportunidad de estar con el doctor Downs ahí en los pasillos. Y bueno, yo les diría, adelante. Y bueno, pues aprovechemos su generosidad del doctor Downs y sobre todo sus conocimientos para aprender un poco más sobre el conectivismo. Bien, a nombre de la Sociedad Mexicana de Computación y Educación, no nos resta más que darle un un regalo muy significativo y una constancia de participación aquí de esta maravillosa conferencia que nos acaba el doctor Downs, y le agradecemos nuevamente su generosidad y el hecho de estar aquí con nosotros. Y doctor Downs, esto es para usted a nombre de la Sociedad Mexicana de Cosmos.
Muchas gracias.
Bien, pues pasamos a la otra.
Es así como hemos concluido la magnífica presentación del doctor Downs.